objections were things that we knew we could solve over time. Even folks who didn't want to join were for reasons that were really personal or idiosyncratic. And a large number of very, very impressive team members who had very interesting opportunities joined, which almost at some point, I think, made us scratch our head and wonder. The natural conclusion was we're onto something. So it really came from, I would say, analyzing why we were getting rejected.
Hi, welcome to Forbes India's The Startup Fridays, which are weekly conversations with accomplished entrepreneurs, VC investors, and other folk who are doing significant work in India's startup ecosystem. You can find a new episode every Friday evening. You can also find us live on Instagram every Friday morning. I'm Hari Arakali, and my guest today is Dr. Vinay B. Nair. He has a PhD. He's founder and CEO of Tiffin, which is a fintech venture out of US, also operations in other parts of the world, including India. And Tiffin provides technology and expertise to business clients to apply AI to personalize their financial products and services to their end customers and consumers. Vinay is a serial entrepreneur. He's an investor and an academic as well. He started with an engineering degree from Indian Institute of Technology, Madras. And then he has a PhD in finance and economics from New York University. He founded Tiffin in 2018. Previously, he's been a hedge fund manager. He's founded multiple startups, including 55 institutional partners. It was an investment advisory that was acquired by JP Morgan. He continues to be a visiting professor at the Wharton School, where he started out as an academic. And in 2008, he also co-authored a book titled Investing for Change, a book that argues in favor of responsible investing, which I guess is way more relevant today as things are developing. And the book was published by Oxford University Press. So, Vinay, absolutely fantastic to have you with us. And thank you so much for making time at, I think, 9, 9.30 or 10 o'clock, your time in the night there for you.
Thank you, Hari. Great to be here.
All right, excellent. So just to get us started, let's start with the simple stuff. Give us a snapshot. I know it's a very long journey, but give us a snapshot of the path that led you to the beginnings of Tiffin, and you know, we'll go from there.
Absolutely. So Hari, as you said, you know, my training is as an engineer, and that I would say was the foundation of the path that led to entrepreneurship and to Tiffin. My first job actually was teaching. I was in 10th grade, I think. I put out some flyers in my housing complex at that point in time in Mumbai, and decided I'm going to teach DBase, Lotus, and Word to other kids around. Surprisingly, a bunch of people paid for it, and that was my first paying job. And when I look back at it, it's interesting because it was perhaps entrepreneurship. It was definitely related to tech, and it was related to teaching. So I've seen those three things link up through my entire career. And Tiffin introduces one more element to those things, which is really finance, which of course I picked up later through the PhD and the teaching of finance. And Tiffin was really built around that central premise that you could have significant impact if you helped people with financial wellness. And if you could bring together the ability to teach, educate, and use technology to improve financial wellness, then we could build some pretty amazing products. That was really the genesis behind Tiffin. Now, there's a big gap between me doing that at 15 and starting Tiffin much older, but the big gap essentially was just building on those foundations.
I definitely want to get into that a little bit more. I'm just curious about what your engineering degree was in and what got you interested in finance.
The engineering degree was in chemical engineering and industrial engineering. So very related to finance. what got me into finance was in my third year of engineering, I was intrigued And I started doing a bachelor's in business administration course through correspondence from Madras University. And I had an internship at American Express Bank, which got me familiar with some aspects of finance. And that was that. But coincidentally, in my fourth year, one of my professor's students, who was a professor at NYU, saw my thesis, my BTEC thesis, and invited me to come to NYU, which I did without knowing much about it. And at NYU, I met a professor, Yaakov Amihud, who convinced me I should be in economics and finance, and I moved. So it really wasn't that well thought through, but I'm glad I did it.
Briefly, let's get into TIFIN itself, but just briefly, what did this professor say to you?
You know, Yaakov is a dear friend, mentor. He guess saw something and said you should be in finance, and got me admission in there. So I didn't really debate it too much at that point in time as a student. I was looking for RA-ships, research assistantships, and Yaakov was giving me one. So, but that was really my entry into finance.
All right. Okay. So let's get into TIFIN a little bit more. What's the significance of the name? I mean, I'm thinking the fin part is to do with finance, but how did you think of TIFIN?
TIFIN, you know, speaking to an Indian audience, you'll appreciate TIFIN was a pun on the idea of several ideas, several containers put together, like a bento box or a TIFIN box. But also it was technology and intelligence, T&I. For finance. So the idea was initially when TIFIN started, it really started off as a venture studio where we were founding or co-founding companies in the space of wealth and investment management. Over time, it evolved into really creating one unified platform where these things we built were brought together to solve what we felt could be a bigger problem. But when it first started, it was really a collection of different companies, a collection of different ideas, much like a TIFIN box. So we played with that pun and the concept of it to come up with TIFIN.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, since you said it's a collection of different ideas and companies, but maybe you can still give us a sense of probably what was sort of the core first product and who were your first customers? How did they use it?
Yeah, the first product is something was and it still exists, is something called Magnify, M-A-G-N-I-F-I. So you could go, I would encourage you to explore it on magnify.com. It started as a simple search functionality. And the premise was, the mission was and is investing success simplified. How do we really simplify people's investing prowess and their chances to succeed? And what struck us was that almost every aspect of your life today, discovery and search, it looks very different from how it looks in the world of finance. So if you go to if you go to any finance site, you have to type in tickers or use screens or use filters. It's almost like you need to know the prescription medicine names, you know, as a consumer, which you need doctors for. And we felt that we could build a search engine specific to the world of investments, much like you have for flights or for various domains. And at that point in time, I spoke to several senior folks at Google and other places and came to realize that a lot of the people who know the tech don't know enough fin to build something like this. A lot of people who know the fin don't know the tech to build something like this. So from scratch, we started building an ontology, which is really, think of it as taxonomies that are interrelated with each other, and started the project to build a search engine from scratch. It was first launched in early 2020. We did a pilot in 19 and launched in early 2020. And the first year, we reached about 1 million search results that we displayed. And last year, we went from 1 million to 100 million search results displayed. And the product has, of course, evolved. We've gone from search to both what happens before search and what happens after search. So we've gone to some inspiration pages where we're releasing streaming content to help people think about what to search for, the inspiration, if you will. And we've also connected to actionability, where you can go buy and trade. And very recently, we released something I'm very excited about, which is our conversational AI assistant. It's the world's first. Think of it like Alexa for investments, or a Siri for investments, or a Google Assistant for investments. We call it Mentor. It's in the beta phase. But the idea is this could be an intelligence layer on top of any brokerage. It could be an intelligence layer on top of any investment workplace. So that's what Magnify is today, 2 years in, 2.5 years in. And I think we'll really change how we all look at investing.
Amazing. I mean, instead of saying, Alexa, play this song for me, you say, Tiffin, whatever you call the voice assistant, buy this stock for me, or should I buy this stock? Give me advice. I mean, those are the kinds of things you're thinking about.
Yeah, in spirit. So you could say, Alexa, what is inflation? Why does it matter? How does it affect my investments? You could say, what happened to markets? How should I react? Or you could say, I want to invest to support climate change. What should I do? These are all different journeys that you can go through in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's just step back a wee bit and sort of, you alluded to it a little bit when you talked about teaching and helping people understand investing better. So just talk about, from your perspective, sort of the core philosophy at Tiffin, you know, your broader vision, what informs everything that you do at Tiffin?
The core, I think what informs everything we do is impact. I would say for us, the number of lives we could potentially touch is an important metric when we think about when we think about what project we should do, how we should do it. You know, people often think of TAM, think of an impact version of TAM as our first metric. The second is, of course, we have, for us, the instrument we have for impact is finance and investing in particular. We think that what fintech has done in the world of payments or lending or banking or insurance or real estate is still, in the world of wealth and investments, it's still very new. Fintech hasn't done much in these areas relative to, say, payments, which started 20 plus years back. So Tiffin really aims to be the global brand in wealth. That's really our ambition. We think that we could bring in personalization the way Netflix has done for movies or Spotify has done for music. We could do that in the world of wealth at a global level across different wealth journeys. So if we can do that, then the impact we can have would basically touch anyone who's touching money, who has maybe a payments app, which can be powered through a Tiffin API on wealth. It could be an employer-employee relationship where you have financial wellness platforms increasingly, which could be powered by Tiffin technology. It could be Magnify, where you can come in and build your own portfolio, create your own account. So we really think of ourselves as builders of engines in the world of wealth. Those engines use AI, those engines use investment intelligence, but we build these engines and we are happy to deliver these to intermediaries, financial advisors, wealth managers, banks, consumer fintechs that are touching the individual and their money. And we're also using some of these things at Magnify, which is our own marketplace. So that's really the core of what we do. How can we make investing intelligence personalized and delivered in engaging ways for high impact?
And so from the impact perspective, give us a sense of what you have already achieved so far at Tiffin, you know, the scale of operations, the people you've touched, customers, some of the biggest customers, investors who are backing you, funding raise, partnerships, so on. So sort of give us a snapshot of all of that.
Absolutely. Now, we're still in the early days. Today, there's over about 3 million individuals in our subscriber base. Magnify in particular has over 125,000 accounts and about $1 trillion in assets behind the people registered on Magnify. Many of there's about 3,000 financial advisors that are registered. We also have more generally across the platform about 6,000 financial advisors, many of whom are free subscribers. Roughly 1,000 of them are paid subscribers. Now, you have to understand that in the US, this is still a very small fraction. There's about 300,000 financial advisors that manage about $20 trillion. So we are still touching only a fraction of this market. While the numbers might seem significant, we think it's still very early in terms of usage and users. And many of our products weren't, Magnify, I mentioned to you, was the first 2 years back. And we've been releasing products probably every 3 to 6 months since then, including the most recent one was released 6 months back. So many of these things are still new. And part of that innovation culture allows us also to continue our growth in a way which is perhaps unusual for a single product firm. Now, in terms of our team, we've grown over the last 2 years from about 50 people to about 300 people. Roughly half the team is in India, half the team is in the US. And in India, the team is in Mumbai and Bangalore predominantly. In terms of investors, we have done 4 rounds, Series A, B, C, D, and have really been fortunate to have a terrific group of investors who are long-duration, strategic value-add investors. So some examples would be a JP Morgan, Franklin Templeton, Morningstar, Broadridge, Hamilton Lane, Motive Partners. These are the investors that know the industry really well, especially the industry we are involved in, and are helping us in different ways. So that's just to give you a sense of some of the ecosystem that we have been supported by in our quest to have this financial impact.
So, from an entrepreneur's perspective, and I would imagine other entrepreneurs who are watching and listening would also be interested in this question. At what point did you realize that you're really onto something with your idea at Tiffin?
It's a great question, Hari. As any entrepreneur knows, you get a lot of rejections, whether that's in the process of raising capital, whether that's in the process of hiring people, whether that's in the process of selling your products to clients. I think what struck me about 2 years back was around our Series A, actually, when we did our first round, was that all the rejections we were getting were for reasons that were really not fundamental. Almost everyone agreed that what we were trying to solve for was interesting, that we could do it. But the reasons were either it's too early or the valuation is too high or all reasons that eventually would go away. And in all those discussions, not one person said, "We don't think this is the team to do it. We don't think this is an interesting problem to solve." At no point did anyone tell us that this was not an interesting problem to solve or not a big enough problem to solve, or that they didn't believe this team could solve it. Even customers, most of the time, the objections were things that we knew we could solve over time. Even folks who didn't want to join were for reasons that were really personal or idiosyncratic. And a large number of very, very impressive team members who had very interesting opportunities joined, which almost at some point, I think, made us scratch our head and and wonder. The natural conclusion was we're onto something. So it really came from, I would say, analyzing why we were getting rejected.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You spoke about the direction in which you're headed, making a sort of really simple assistant that anyone can use. Sort of at the bigger platform level, give us a simple layman's understanding of what's at the heart of the technology that you've developed so far.
Absolutely. So there are a few different things, components that come together. One aspect of it is simply the investment science. This is where all the academic research that I've done, that others have done, the financial science, how do we deliver all that to folks in simple ways? So you'll see a lot of our algos utilize some of this investment science. The second component of this is really, how do we deliver this in ways that is personalized, that is relevant for the person? So to do that, you need data. So we capture data when users search things or read things so that we can give them back recommendations that are specific to them. The third component, so the first is investment science, second is data. And the third component is using modern technology, which changes how machine and humans interact. So I gave you the example of natural language search, where the mentor is another example of conversational AI. And the world of conversational AI is changing dramatically. And I believe that how businesses will interact with their clients is going to shift pretty significantly in the next 3 to 10 years. And OpenAI type of firms, which have released newer versions of conversational AI engines, what's called GPT-3, already is so much better than GPT-2 that it's only a matter of time that the typical machine-generated text versus human-generated text, you won't be able to tell any difference between it. So as technology advances to change the interaction between machine and people, as science advances to understand more, and as we collect more data about what is truly relevant for you, everything we do brings these three things together to create the engines that I spoke to you about before.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the big picture context in which, you know, companies like Tiffin are serving their customers today. I mean, the book that you wrote back in 2008-2009, you all argued for responsible investing, and today the world seems so much more uncertain, with so many different things becoming so much more urgent, whether it's COVID or the current slowdown or climate change being more urgent. So if you look at the time since you wrote that book up till now, what are some of the important ways you see that globalization is changing, and you know how we ought to be reacting to it, and maybe connected to the role that companies like Tiffin can play?
Yeah, I think that book was definitely ahead of its time. And today, the amount of consensus and attention that exists from capital providers, from capital allocators to those topics has been very encouraging. So I think broadly, the investment community understands the importance of solving these problems. If you look at the amount of capital that's going into trying to solve these problems, it's an order of magnitude higher than it was 15 years ago, so which is very encouraging. The private sector effectively is trying to solve these problems much more today, rather than leaving it entirely to the public sector. And I am pretty, you know, optimistic about that, because at the core of it, innovation today in the US contributes about 50% to US GDP. The growth, the GDP growth, 50% of the growth comes from innovation. So, and the capital going into innovation is dramatically high. I think what people don't realize is about 0.2% of all capital is VC capital. And yet VC-funded companies drive about 21% of US GDP. So I think if there's enough innovation capital that goes behind problems, those problems get solved one way or another. And I haven't seen the amount of capital, you know, I haven't seen 10 years ago the amount of capital going into solving these problems as I see today. So there's obviously a lagging indicator, but I think that innovation is a very powerful instrument in trying to solve social problems. And today, many entrepreneurs are much more socially minded, impact driven. Many investors realize that by solving these problems, they can get interesting returns. And there's a significant awareness around these problems. So when you put these together, I'm in the camp of the private sector and the individual consumer coming together to have much more impact on these problems than leaving it to politicians and policymakers, which has been a welcome shift over the last 15 years.
So would you say that you have a degree of optimism that, you know, we will make a dent with all these problems?
Yes, I do. I think that we often have the tendency to linearly extrapolate, which is very natural if we do that, to be pessimistic about some of the things. And yet at the core of it, innovation functions non-linearly. And I think that sometimes is difficult to see by extrapolating the past.
And bringing it back to Tiffin, I would imagine that you're already building in some of the tools that, you know, your 3,000 advisors who are already using your platform would use to look for, you know, sort of the optimal balance between profits and responsible investing. And would you say that such things are already happening now?
Such things are happening in the industry. And I think the whole debate, which is a conversation we can spend a bunch of time on, it's not clear that there is a trade-off anymore between returns and social impact. You know, as more and more the externalities, the social impact gets priced in, what is good for your returns is what is good for social impact. So you're seeing more and more of that evolve. It's not for purely philanthropic reasons that BlackRock would announce this is one of the biggest initiatives. It is also, I think, the right thing to do to the bottom line. And I think that trade-off, that compromise, increasingly is going away as markets are pricing these things in.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about your own entrepreneurial journey. You said you were in Bombay. Tell us a bit about where you were born, where you grew up, what your parents did, things like that.
I was born in Kerala, but never really lived there, except visit and vacations. My dad was an engineer, and my mother was a homemaker. And we grew up all around India. So he used to work for a firm called Engineers India Limited, EIL, and had a transferable job. So we moved. I spent my early years in Assam, Bengal, Chennai. Mumbai was the longest in any one place where I did my high school, did my 12th grade there, and then to IIT Madras. So that was really the journey. Very, you know, very traditional middle class Indian family, and a great childhood. Couldn't thank my parents enough.
So from a career perspective and from a professional perspective, you look back. What are some of your earliest memories of what you now see as maybe some big influences? On, you know, sort of what influenced your career, your decisions in terms of your work and so on, looking back?
A lot of people, effectively. You know, I think obviously my dad being an engineer was an influence in me applying and getting into IIT and taking that engineering path. along the way, meeting folks that opened up the possibilities. Right, I didn't know what a dividend meant when I was 17 or 18, and the exposure with different people coming in. I mentioned to you one of the professors at NYU, and there are several people along the way. If I will broadly, I would say I just haven't been someone who's planned 3-5 years ahead, and I think the opportunities have opened largely because of someone helping. And in many cases, you know, I think it just felt right. So that's really my career has evolved to a large extent.
Have you ever consciously, deliberately thought about what pushed you into wanting to be an entrepreneur, and what came out of that kind of thinking?
Yeah, few things. One is, I would say, and this sounds a bit counterintuitive, but I would say the academic training actually plays a big role. Partially because, you know, at least as a well-trained researcher, you are looking for problems that haven't been solved before. You have no interest in trying to do something generally incremental. You're trying to really write papers which are going to be published in top journals, which means you have to say something that hasn't been said before. Engineering in my IIT really taught me how to build things. When I combined these two things, you know, when I was teaching at Wharton, a source of frustration for me was that I was not building things. It was all very theoretical in the context of things. So when I put those two together and you look around the world and you notice there are some problems that haven't been solved well, and you've picked up tools to build things to solve them, I think entrepreneurship became a very natural conduit to express this. But that combination, I think, was very important. If it was just one of the two, I'm not sure it would have naturally led to the type of firm we are building. Because look, Tiffin really is a combination of about half a dozen separate companies that we founded and then merged together to create Tiffin. It's a platform of fintechs, which is now running as one fintech, which I think is difficult to do unless you think of several problems and are trying to come up with ideas. And I think I attribute my academic training a lot for that.
Mm-hmm. If you look back at your entire entrepreneurial, academic, professional experience, what are some of the top takeaways? So look at it as like the top three lessons, you know, that others could take away from your experience.
So I'll share that, but also say it's all very path dependent and everyone's path could be quite different. But I would say the three, in the context of building firms, I would say the three things, three lessons that I've learned are, one, choose the people you work with carefully. And when I say that, I mean, try to work with people you enjoy spending time with. You know, I think broadly to me, the amount of time you spend at work and the relationships you form in there, if you don't enjoy those relationships, it's not sustainable, the work and the enjoyment factor in it. The second lesson I would say is pick a problem that really speaks to you. Pick a problem that you would solve, even if the financial payoff is not super high, even if no one was watching. Pick a problem that really resonates with you at an intrinsic level. So that purpose element also makes what you're doing much more sustainable and elicits a type of passion or interest that just becomes a magnet to, I believe, the universe helping you broadly in solving that problem. And the third is really execution. I would say that speed is probably the single biggest source of risk management. Often people think of it as a source of risk. Moving fast is a source of risk. I believe moving fast is risk management in entrepreneurial world, because that's how you do more with less faster, and you move faster than larger firms who just cannot do that. So those would be my three big lessons: people, purpose, and speed.
You're CEO yourself of Tiffin, and you're also the founder. How should an entrepreneur, in your view, approach being a founder with a certain vision for the future of the venture versus being its CEO as well, answerable to a board and investors and other stakeholders?
Yeah, I think I started 55YP, and I hired a CEO, and I stepped away and became a founder chairman before I started Tiffin. So I've struggled with that balance in the past and have learned along the journey. And I think it's an important topic to build a philosophy on. First, I would say that at the end of the day, you know, all the stakeholders that you're talking about, investors, board members, we are all serving the customer. We are all serving the user, employees, etc. If that becomes the North Star, I think it's much easier to create alignment between everyone else. So I think sometimes that's not explicit, or that's not the North Star in organizations, and that starts becoming a problem. The second is, I would say that often, you know, everyone comes in trying to solve seemingly the same problem when they present their views, but they may have different objective functions. Maybe an investor wants to exit next year. Another one wants to exit 10 years from now. Another one doesn't care about exit. And sometimes they have different constraints. So I think it's really helpful to understand in any discussion, are we aligned on what we're trying to solve, and are we aligned on what the constraints are? I think having a good understanding of that really helps create overall alignment. Otherwise, everyone thinks they're solving the same problem, and they all differ because they're not solving the same problem. And I found that to be super helpful in discussions, just bringing it out in the open. And lastly, I think it's important to understand that they all have backed the firm largely because they believe in the vision of the founder and the execution skills of the CEO. And as the CEO, I think I've often found that you need this right balance between humility and arrogance, if you will. When you get feedback from the board or from others, I think you have to pay careful attention to that feedback and ask yourself, are you being arrogant to dismiss it? And vice versa. I think sometimes when you're just taking feedback, you have to ask yourself, are you really being too humble and just listening to feedback? And finding that balance is really, I think, the evolution of a serial entrepreneurship journey if you want to be the CEO as well. I also believe, Harry, that at different stages, I may not be the right CEO at a different stage of this firm. I also believe that at different stages of the firm, you need different type of execution skills. People might grow or they may not grow, but at the core of it, a CEO should be evaluated based on the execution skills, which is different from a founder or a chairman who's more of a coach. So it's been a great learning journey that I hope will continue.
Tell us about one or two most pivotal experiences in your professional life which affected your professional life. Maybe the worst low point, the biggest high point so far, and what they taught you.
Well, there have been many. One common thing I would say, almost that most low points share, it's all people related. So, which has been an interesting common pattern. High points are not people related, but the low points are often people related. The high points could be, you know, an exit or a product launch. Most recently, of course, selling 55 IP 2 years back to JP Morgan, at a very successful exit scenario, was a high point, which really helped us build conviction around our thesis at Tiffin that you could build innovation engines around wealth journeys and help the industry move towards the next generation. And what's been even more satisfying is that 55IP continues to do very well, and JP Morgan is very happy with the purchase. 2 years in, continues as a great investor with Tiffin. So all the employees are still, the CEO employees are still there. They're thriving. So when I look at that particular journey from beginning to exit to post-exit, often people stop at exit, to post-exit, the impact that firm is having externally to the buyer, to the team members working in there, has been collectively a high point. Not any one event, the journey has been a high point.
Very nice. Talk about how that experience informs your decisions today in the current scenario. I mean, in general, everyone's talking about how VC money is once again going to be difficult to raise, and business itself will be tough. I mean, sales cycle will be extended, so on. Perhaps you have your way of looking at this. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Look, seasons change. We are entering a different season. Seasons will change again, and we will come out of the season. So this is not going to be a permanent state of affairs for the future. So first, the way I look at this is, if you want to build a multi-generational firm, you have to go through a generational crisis. There's just no way around it. And every firm that we look up to has done that, whether it's an Amazon or, you know, pick your favorite firm in there. They've all gone through phases and cycles. And we are, perhaps, and I believe we are, entering a cycle, which will be a challenging cycle. And it'll be challenging for multiple reasons. Now, the inflation, interest rates staying high for a prolonged period of time is particularly bad for innovation. Because effectively all future cash flows get discounted at a higher rate, so valuations drop, cost of capital becomes expensive. I don't believe interest rates will stay high for a prolonged period of time. I think they will go up and they'll probably come down and stabilize. We are shored up. The way we've kind of designed our capital strategy and our cost structure and how we're running our firm is we don't need to go to markets for the next 2 years. And that partially, I think, is why we think we could use this environment and really lay a strong foundation for the next season. But if you have to go and raise capital in this cycle, it will be challenging. And the capital is available, mind you. There is $500 million in VC dollars sitting out there. You know, in total, VCs have $2 trillion, private equity firms have $6 trillion. There's plenty of capital. So you may not like the valuations, but if you're building a solid business which has strong fundamentals, you'll get money to build it, is my view.
Yeah, probably in the context of using the current scenario as an opportunity. I mean, I stumbled upon one of the comments that you posted, I think inspired by Ayrton Senna's comment about overtaking cars in the rain. I didn't know about it. After reading your post, I looked it up. Tell us a little bit about what you were thinking about when you posted that, what it means to you in the current slowdown and so on.
Yeah, I mean, Artin Sinha was obviously brilliant in what he did. Look, you probably relate to this. Sometimes you drive and you're not even paying attention, and somehow you reach your destination. You know, it's a road you take all the time. You're thinking of something else, you're talking on the phone, you're taking a subconscious left and right, and you get to where you want to get to. And then there are times when, you know, you're driving through a mountain and it's snowing or pouring and it's night and you have kids in the back seat and you're paying total attention. You're focused on it. I think that economically speaking, if this is a phase where you can be really focused and really attentive and get a huge advantage. Not only is it required, but I think it could be a competitive edge, because this is the type of phase which really separates out quality. It separates out the challenging circumstances, help separate out stronger firms from weaker firms. We believe that soon you will have a bunch of firms dealing with the current economic situation and potentially crisis. And there'll be firms who will take advantage of the firms dealing with the situation. But there will be a separation between, that's how the consolidation works, that's how cycles work. And I think which category do you want to belong to is going to effectively be dictated by how focused you could be and how well trained you are and what your fundamental business is. So think of the driver and the track and the car. You need all those three things to really get to a state where the current environment could be a good thing for you.
Excellent. Kind of run out of time, Vinay. Wonderful conversation. Thank you again for making time kind of late at night for you. Truly enjoyed it and definitely hope to keep the conversation going.
Thank you, Hari. Likewise, it was a pleasure.
All right. So that was Dr. Vinay Nair, founder and CEO of Tiffin. That's it for this week's Startup Fridays. Wherever you've been watching us, listening to us, I hope you're staying safe and doing well. Until next time, have a great Friday and a wonderful weekend ahead.